So, this week's double parsha, Bahar Bahukotai, offers us the commandments and all the logistical details of the Shemitah and Jubilee years. Can you hear me okay? Yep, good. The land, just like God and like us, must be given a time of rest every 7th year. The people are not to sow their fields or prune their vineyards, but must let them grow wild while the land is given a complete Shabbat. Every 50th year, after 7 cycles of these 7-year cycles, there will be a Jubilee year in which the land is given a second year of rest after the 49th year. All properties purchased during the previous 49 years are returned to the original owner families, and liberty is granted to all Israelites enslaved during the previous 49 years. If you try to understand the logistical details of this parsha, you may get caught up in trying to figure out how a people who had grown accustomed to living off manna while wandering in the desert for 40 years could enter the land where they were to settle and become farmers, and then immediately have to wait a year before planting and another year before reaping harvest. And then, because the parsha begins with, "When you enter the land that I assign to you, the land shall observe a Shabbat of God." So then you start wondering, how could they manage if after 7 cycles with this extra Jubilee year, when there's no planting or reaping, then there's a 3-year gap before they can begin to have harvests again because it takes a year for the unplanted fields to grow, even when they're planted. So I also would wonder, as I tried to figure out the logistics, what's the logic of returning property to its first Israelite owner every 50 years? And it would be explained to me that this would help even out economic prosperity, bringing it back to where it was when the land was first distributed, so no one family could accumulate more than others. But then I think, what if some tribes had started out on land with better soil, better conditions, and the less resourced tribes could never catch up? However, as long as I focused on tracking these details, I couldn't see the point. But this year, with the help of Aviva Zornberg's interpretation of multiple commentaries, I recognized that certain basic truths about existence could be discovered through observance of these embodied ritual practices of cyclical rest, return, and release. So some of these truths are: 1, you cannot own anything forever. All ownership is impermanent. Ownership of land, ownership of wealth, ownership of our bodies, none of these ownerships last forever. 2, 1/7 of every life needs to be devoted to rest, to relief, to being left alone. Zornberg points out that we shouldn't imagine this romantically as a return to Gan Eden. Don't imagine, she warns, beautiful, lovely landscaping. We're commanded to let the land become wild, overgrown. We're letting it go. We're allowing a bit of wildness to appear in our orderly lives. Without this wildness, says Zornberg, we might go mad from our repetitive routines. Or, as Tenzin Namdok reminded us with a quote we began with in meditation, we lose touch with our natural state from which creative possibility arises. So, 3, we could go mad if we don't take a rest and allow the wildness to emerge. I thought of this as I walked around Jamaica Pond the other morning, where there are untended stretches of trees and brush, We often mention here how immersing ourselves in nature is restoring. We need to make space for this untended proliferation that offers respite from the tension, the need to keep things in order all the other days of the week or all the years of the Shemitah cycle. And four, there's an important practice of abstinence. We're told you can eat the fruit, but you can't harvest it to sell and benefit through trade. You have to do with less than you're used to, cyclically. And this cyclical practice of abstinence appears in all faiths, like fasting for Ramadan, not eating meat for Lent, and our own fasting observances. And if you aspire to accumulate a lot of wealth, you still have to release from debt all who may owe you money and return all the land you have accumulated in the 50th year. So this truth is that the impulse to accumulate more, our greed and craving, we're commanded on a regular basis not to satisfy them. Abstinence is enforced, and interestingly, intermittent abstinence is a practice recommended by addiction specialists today for all types of compulsive habits, whether it's substances or use of the internet, based on an understanding of how dopamine acts on the reward system. But a couple of millennia ago, even without understanding neurobiology, this same practice was required of us in order to stay as sojourners, gerim, on the land. We had to practice this to combat our natural tendencies of always wanting more. Six, Hebrew slaves need to be given a choice of freedom every 50 years. Four, we were released from Mitzrayim in order to serve God, not to serve other masters. I'll talk more about this later. Seven, there's rewards and punishments. After receiving these commandments in Parsha Behar, in Parsha Behukotai, we read the intense incentives for observing the laws and the punishments for ignoring them. If you follow these laws of cyclical rest, moderating greed, releasing debtors, releasing Hebrew slaves, then you will have the blessings of abundant crops, prosperity, peace, safety from wild beasts, and victory over enemies. But if you do not follow these commandments, you'll be cursed with diseases, crop failure, the death of your livestock and children. You will know fear and starvation and be defeated and ravaged by your enemies. And the torment is psychological as well as physical. Bread will be baked for you and doled out to you, but you will not be satisfied. Like, isn't this actually what happens with addiction? It's never enough. You can't be satisfied. Your land will be desolate, your cities ruined, and this curse will last for as many years as you have ignored the Shemitah cycles, for as many years as you worked the land when you were supposed to be giving it rest. And the land shall rest and make up for its Sabbath years. Eight, for those who survive, punishment is a form of madness, paranoia that has grown unchecked in the one who has worked and worked to accumulate wealth and then loses everything and then is terrified of everyone and everything. It's described graphically, the sound of a driven leaf will put them to flight, fleeing as though from the sword. They shall fall, though no one pursues. And yet, finally, all is not lost. The curse does not last forever. And God promises, I will not destroy them, for I am the Eternal. I am their God. I will remember in their favor the covenant with the ancients whom I freed from the land of Egypt in the sight of the nations to be their God, I the Eternal. So let's look more closely at just a couple of these commandments. to understand the shared intent of Torah and our meditation practices that train us through embodied practice to understand these truths about our lives. The Hebrew words describing how the land does not belong to you are Ki li ha'aretz, ki gerim v'toshvim atem imadi. For the land is mine, and you are gerim, sojourners and resident aliens with me. We are renters, not landlords of this earth, and we are renters in our earthly bodies as well. This dwelling place also cannot be kept forever. In other words, everything that you enjoy on this physical plane, all your fortune, your land, everything, including your body, is not a permanent possession. The underlying message is similar to what one chants before every sit in Zen practice, that we are of the nature to get ill, to get old, and to die, that we will lose everyone and everything we love, and that our deeds are our only possessions. This similarity is not surprising. After all spiritual practices help us with the brutal reality of being mortal, of knowing we are destined to lose everything. Buddhist practice confronts our desire to accumulate, our cravings, in a different way, by training the mind to be less driven by cravings for accumulating more and more. Parsha Bahar does not confront the craving head on, but instead the many laws and rituals shape our behavior so that we have to enact the practice of letting go every 50 years of what we've accumulated. And I'll wrap up with a reflection on the rule that every 50 years, all Israelite slaves must be given a choice to be freed. However, we have been told previously in Exodus that if a Hebrew slave chooses to remain enslaved, he receives a strange punishment. He shall be brought to the door or the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall then remain his master's slave for life. Why should he receive punishment? Why is this strange punishment in his ear? Zornberg quotes several commentaries that suggests an answer may be found in the last lines of Parsha Bahar, which reiterate the rules for freeing Hebrew slaves and connect them with the second commandment. In our Parsha today, Bahar ends with, "For it is me that the Israelites are it is to me that the Israelites are servants. They are my servants whom I freed from the land of Egypt. I, the Eternal, your God." As we often are reminded at Passover, Moses was not instructed by God to demand of Pharaoh simply, "Let my people go," and leave it at that. It was not about freedom to do whatever. Moses heard God's words as, "Let my people go that they may serve me." Idolatry is a form of enslavement to another master. An idol may take many forms. At Sinai, the contract was that we would take on the yoke of the kingdom of heaven. Now, this yoke is not to imply harsh and restricted servitude, but rather a sense of being connected to and in service to something larger. That something larger is called God, and anything else is called idolatry. When we worship any one part rather than the whole, whether it's our work, people we've idealized, money, possessions, rock stars, our own athletic or intellectual prowess, our own spiritual prowess, We are letting this preoccupation and devotion get in the way of our connection to the unfolding of reality in each moment, as Rabbi Jeff Roth has helped us to understand what these four letters, Yud Heh Vav Heh, stand for. As some of you may know, the use of the word yoke is also in the spiritual and meditative practice of yoga. The word yoga is derived from the Sanskrit root yuj, meaning to yoke, join, or unite, signifying the bringing together of different parts of oneself, mind, body, spirit, and connecting individual consciousness with universal consciousness. Zornberg quotes the Sfat Emet, a more recent teacher, in that it is the quality of a chassid to be pious beyond the minimum of the law, to be open and ready and attentive to listen to something from beyond. This is the state that we talked about 2 weeks ago as Reggie led us to reflect on the meaning of Kadoshim, often translated as holy. The Sfat Emet understands Kadosh to mean aspiring to be someone who is alert, engaged, aware, looking out for indications of God in the world, always asking, what does God want from me now? Which is why the Sfat Emet understands Na'aseh V'Nishma, which means first we'll do and then we'll listen, which is kind of the opposite of what you think, oh, I'll hear the orders and then I'll follow them. But he says, Na'aseh, doing, represents the bare minimum of following the law, sheer obedience. And Nishma, listening, means we'll go on listening beyond that. And that is what is meant by Kedoshim, attentiveness to picking up on whatever is being commanded on of me in this moment to serve the whole and not the part. And that, of course, brings us back to reflect on the meaning of that very strange punishment for the person who chooses to be a slave, why the ear is singled out for punishment. Zornberg quotes the Jerusalem Talmud, the part where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai explains, this ear heard at Sinai, you shall not, and these were the words heard at Sinai, you shall not have other gods before me, the second commandment. And this ear went on and required another master for himself. And this brings us back to our own silent practice, the practice of quieting our speech, not listening to others, not getting caught up in listening to our own inner monologues and dialogues and musings. We are learning to recognize the repetitive thoughts that get in the way of simply being open and attuned and listening for indications of how we are being called to serve the reality that is unfolding in each moment.